Hello, 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 and a very warm welcome to the IOPPN Research Festival podcast. The festival takes place in South London on Wednesday the 15th of May, 2024. And this year, the theme is Origins and New Beginnings. There'll be keynote talks from Melanie Abbas, Edgar Jones, and Emily Simonoff. This is always a jam-packed, high-quality event which showcases the exciting and innovative research that comes out of the Institute of Psychiatry, Psychology and Neuroscience. Expect an afternoon of short talks from top researchers, staff and students on a really diverse range of topics. As always, we'll be covering it live from the Mental Health, and this year my colleague Fran Bentivegna will be attending in person and live tweeting from the Mental Health. Follow the hashtag IOPPN Festival for updates. And I'll be recording conversations with keynote speakers to find out a little more about their work. In this first podcast episode, we meet Emily Simonoff, Professor of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry at the Institute, who talks about youth mental health and exciting developments taking place right now on the Denmark Hill campus.
Youth mental health has suddenly, over the last 5 years, become so very topical for the whole population. Everyone is really quite concerned about youth mental health. And frankly, that's with good reason. Epidemiological studies, that is studies that look at the whole population of children and young people, some 10 years ago, were pretty consistently in the UK reporting that about 1 in 10 children, young people had a mental health disorder. If you went back 20 years, you would also get those 1 in 10 rates, so that they were really pretty consistent. But about 5 or 6 years ago, those slowly began to creep up to 1 in 8 and now 1 in 6 amongst children and young people, and particularly in adolescents. The increases seem to have been mainly amongst adolescents. And we were so struck by them that we began to wonder if the surveys were inaccurate and were somehow picking up false rates of endorsement. But there's lots of additional evidence to suggest those are correct. Those go from the increasing rates of referrals to child and adolescent mental health services, which after the initial COVID downs went up about threefold. And we will have heard most topically or most recently about the high rates of young adults now who are saying that they don't feel they can enter the employment arena because of mental health problems. And that perhaps takes us to one of the really important reasons why we focus on children and young people's mental health. First of all, of course, we care about our children and young people. We want all our children to have a wonderful childhood free from mental health disorders, as well as physical health disorders. But also, we know that the majority of adult mental health disorders begin in childhood. So 75% of adult mental health disorders have begun by age 18. If you look backwards, and 50% by age 15. And that means that mental health in childhood is storing up problems for adult life. And it's not just caring about our children and young people, but it's also thinking about what's coming forward for adults and the rest of our society.
And just briefly, what's going on? What's happened in the last few years that's caused this massive increase?
It's a really important question, and it's one we don't have a full answer to. So one hypothesis has been that COVID would have been a particular stressor, and there's a suggestion that maybe a particular stressor for some children with neurodevelopmental conditions like autism and ADHD. However, when you look at the literature that's been published looking at rates of mental health problems before and during COVID, there's a really inconsistent pattern, with some studies showing, yes, a definite increase, other studies showing no increase, in fact, even a decrease in mental health problems. I think other hypotheses include the impact of social media. So children and young people now are growing up in a 24/7 environment where they're sort of bombarded very often by social media of all sorts. It impacts on the way in which they engage with other children and young people. It impacts on their physical activity. It impacts on the quality of their relationships, and it impacts on their sleep. We know young people are often staying up late at night and using social media in various ways. And again, we don't have really good research, but everything that we know suggests that it probably has an impact on children and young people's mental health and their ability to turn off, refresh their brains, do other more habilitative or rehabilitative activities, and just have some downtime. And probably a third area that really needs quite a bit of research and thinking about is whether patterns in society build resilience in young people. And by resilience, what I'm talking about is the idea that when a person is exposed to challenges or stressful experiences, they're able to bounce back from those. And actually even sometimes become stronger as a result of having experienced something stressful, but been able to manage it and you know, in a constructive and helpful way. And there are suggestions that we may be less good now at helping children and young people to become resilient. We may be encouraging them to say, oh, poor you, that's really upsetting, rather than poor you, that was distressing, but let's think of how you're going to manage it. And having that experience of coming out stronger.
You've spoken about this kind of increased interest and increased focus on youth mental health widely, but you're also focusing in South London at the IAPPN more on young people's mental health. Tell us about your exciting plans.
Yeah, so we're incredibly excited to be building the Pears Maudsley Centre for Children and Young People, which will be the home of the King's Maudsley Partnership for Children and Young People. Confusing having two acronyms, but the Pears Maudsley Centre is a 9-story building in the centre of the Denmark Hill IOPPN campus that will bring together clinicians working directly with children and young people and academics, both clinical, that is those of us who both do research but also see patients, and our non-clinical colleagues who focus on mental disorders in children and young people. And we will be brought together in the same space to work together to identify the most pressing questions in children and young people's mental health and find novel ways of addressing those. The center also has an inpatient unit for children and young people and outpatient services for more than 20 of our national and specialist services. And one of the areas that is most exciting for me is that we'll have, to my knowledge, the only children and young people's bespoke clinical research facility aimed at studying mental health in children and young people.
I guess one of the issues we've got currently in mental health is that our services are very splintered and siloed, and our research groups are very sort of splintered and siloed. And we've got this drive that we've had over the last sort of 5 to 10 years, I suppose, to sort of bring these together a bit more, have more cross-disciplinary working, have services which are more joined up. It sounds like what you're doing here is building a clinical research facility, which starts to break down some of those barriers.
That's really one of our key aims, is that the clinicians who are seeing children and young people and saying, but if only I understood this bit of the problem, or I knew how to, you know, address this symptom profile in a different way, these are my biggest clinical problems. And the clinicians are saying that, and the researchers are saying, well, what are the most important problems? What's going to make a difference? And therefore, what should we be prioritizing in terms of our research? So bringing those two groups together to think about how do those clinical issues form a scientific question? And importantly, how do we see where the questions are the same across different clinical disorders? So, for example, where do we see synergies across young people who are coming to us with, for example, depression, and those who are coming to us with ADHD, so that we can find solutions that may pertain to a much wider group of children and young people? We often term that sort of a transdiagnostic approach, but we know that disorders in children and young people very often co-occur. So children with ADHD or autism are much more likely to develop anxiety or depression. And understanding why that's the case, one of the common threads, is really important in terms of developing novel approaches to understanding the conditions and intervening in a timely and effective way.
I've been doing a lot of work recently with the research champions in SLAM, who have these roles where they try and promote research within the trust. And I guess get frontline practitioners more interested in using research in their practice, but also getting their patients involved in research studies that are happening within the trust and within IPPN. I wonder what your thoughts are on how this clinical research facility can help to bridge this gap between frontline practice and academic research. I think a lot of practitioners understand the importance of research, but spend very little time thinking about it in their day-to-day job because they're very busy, thank you very much, with looking after people. What can this centre do in that regard?
So I think it can make a difference in lots of different ways. One example is we'll be able to address questions that really challenge clinicians, but have been difficult to address previously. And I'll just give you an example of one of the studies that will start in the autumn with the clinical research facility. And that's a study of what we call demand avoidance. It's a condition that quite a significant proportion of autistic children and young people experience, where they really don't want to do things, whether it's helping out at home, going to school, coming out of their rooms, engaging with other peers. So it may involve a whole range of different situations. It's concerning for their families and the people around them because they're not engaging in the whole range of life activities that are important for development. But we really don't have good ideas about why some, particularly autistic children and young people, develop demand avoidance profiles and others don't. And it's, you can imagine that by the very nature of being demand avoidant, it's been hard to engage young people in research. But our clinicians see a lot of these children and young people and are really concerned to find more effective ways of treating them. So understanding what might be different about the cognitive, the thinking profiles, the brain function, the sensory experiences of this group of children and young people could give us really important insights in how we might develop novel interventions. And by having a clinical research facility that's, first of all, situated in your clinical building, so your clinician can trot along with that young person and come and support them to be engaged in research, can also feed into these are the research paradigms I think we need to test. I think we need to test how sensitive they are to different sensory experiences, or we need to test something about their cognitive style. They can engage in the research in a question that's really important to them. And furthermore, in terms of the clinical research facility, with children and young people who find it hard to cooperate, and I use that word with inverted commas because it's our idea that people need to comply with a research procedure, we can develop research studies that ask very little of the young person themselves. For example, it might just be viewing different films or listening to different noises while your brain activity is being monitored or your level of physiological arousal is being monitored. So much easier for young people who find it difficult to take part in research, and easy for their clinicians to be involved in and support those young people.
And finally, I'm interested in your thoughts on what impact the new facility is going to have on demand. I guess that's the key question for a lot of families at the moment. The fact they're on waiting lists for 2 years or waiting for an assessment for ADHD or autism or whatever. How do you see it affecting capacity in your part of London?
So realistically, in terms of capacity, in the short term, I think it's not going to have a huge effect. But I think what it is going to allow us to do over time is think about how we deliver mental health care to children and young people more efficiently and effectively. And I often sort of use the analogy of how do we move from open abdominal surgery to keyhole surgery, which changed the patient experience of going in 2 days before surgery for a huge workup and then having to stay in for at least a week and rehabilitate for a month, to coming in for day surgery and being up and about within a couple of days. If we can get closer to more effective ways of understanding for the individual child or young person what's underpinning their mental health condition, so that we're delivering more personalized and targeted interventions, then we would expect that those treatments will be both more efficacious, but also probably more efficient and time limited. So we'll ultimately be able to see a higher number of children. We also want, where possible, to digitize interventions so that we don't have to see all the same proportion of children and young people in person, but rather often with the more mild cases, to offer an app-based treatment or maybe a virtual reality-based treatment that they use at home. And then for those, for example, who need a more personalized and in-person intervention, those are the ones that come in and see a therapist. And that would potentially make treatment for children and young people hugely scalable, not only for South London, but for the UK and globally as well.
Thanks very much to Emily for joining us and taking the time to trail her IOPPN Festival keynote talk. We look forward to covering that in more detail on May the 15th in London. If you'd like to attend the Research Festival in person, free tickets are available. Just follow the link in the podcast description to the Eventbrite page. And look out for more podcast episodes coming up with Melanie Abbas and Edgar Jones. That's it for now. This is Andre signing off. I'll see you all soon.